In 1967, we awoke to the knowledge of the village. Now, 50 years on, we invite you good citizens to join us in celebrating the timeless topics, eloquent prose and striking visuals of the iconic programme, The Prisoner.
Greetings. Greetings, good people. All members of the village's literary society are invited to convene in the library atrium for a delightful discussion by numbers 28 and 89 about the Powers media books The Prisoner's Dilemma and Miss Freedom.
Number 28.
Number 89.
When it comes to your reading endeavors, are you more of a fiction fan or are you a non-fiction reader?
I never read fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, I never read fiction.
Yeah.
I read nonfiction. I read a lot of science stuff. I read periodicals like The Atlantic and The New Yorker and those sorts of things. And, you know, archaeology, history, paleontology, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, not used to this sort of thing.
Me neither. And that's why it's really been funny. But this very enjoyable endeavor has changed my, I guess if you will, my intellectual bent. Because we read the 60s books. We've read the graphic novels. I guess you could say we read the magazines. Those are a little bit more nonfiction.
Yeah.
But digging into these Powers books.
Yeah.
These are big asks for two guys who aren't fiction
fans. Well,
yours
especially. Yours is longer than mine.
Oh,
mine is relatively small compared to yours. Yours is you like the word tome, and it's kind of tome-ish.
It is kind of a tome. But
tomey.
These are books I've also owned for a while and read before. That doesn't mean the reread is that easy.
Hmm.
I do, however, think that they are amazing contributions to both the conversation we've been having and to this, if you will, collection of Prisoner expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So, as always, to share the load, what we decided to do was to each take a book, right? Both of them produced, as described just a couple weeks ago by Matteo, in this fascinating world of how he got the rights and shepherded these books into being. And then last week, well, Rupert didn't really talk much because time, as he mentioned, has eroded some of his memory. Didn't talk too much about Rupert's creation of the book, but I think we still got some insights. We do have, of course, the conversation last year with Andrew about his writing of Miss Freedom. And I feel like what now you and I can do after having that amazing opportunity to hear the three true creators, minus the fact that we have not had the chance as yet to talk to Jonathan Blum, and I hope we do, and I know he would be very disposed to it, which is wonderfully and kind. But we're going to dig in and give our perspectives on each book we read. You read?
I read Miss Freedom, Andrew Cartmell.
Yep. And I took The Prisoner's Dilemma. So back in this the village schoolhouse, let me see if I can take you on a trek through mine, and then we'll trade up. You tell me a little bit about yours. So it's 2005, and these two gentlemen, Jonathan and Rupert, come together, again through the auspice of Matteo Latosa, and they take on the first, if you will, challenge of writing a massive prisoner novel. Now, granted, we had the three books from Ace that we read, we liked, we talked about, but the difference now, and I think the difference of why these are both maybe both praised and criticized, is that these authors have had 30, 35 years of prisoner lore and information to help them write their books. That being said, I tried to read it both as just a great work of fiction and where does it feed into my prisoner knowledge. But I also can't help when I read fiction to me, the idea is that it's supposed to generate more conversation, not just read the book, but say, oh, look what that author said or did that stimulated me to have other ideas. So in this gorgeous edition, which interestingly enough, back to the people in our neighborhood, do you know that Robert Fairclough was the one who did this graphic design for the cover?
Oh, okay.
Isn't that pretty?
Yeah, it's lovely.
One more manifestation of his art. In all these levels of detail, what I loved was, and I'd asked Rupert about this, he didn't recall. Maybe Jonathan was the instigator of this. This book is so rich in all of its homage to The Prisoner that one of the first things is that though it's divided into four sections, and each section has lots of chapters, you'll notice as I pass to number 28 that they elected not to have a single chapter that has a 7 or a derivative of 7. Like there's no chapter 7, 17, 27. I thought that, to use your word, was a little cheeky.
It is cheeky.
It is cute.
Yeah, I think Prisoner fans appreciate these little things. It keeps you, people like to discover things. And people, you know, so this, it's one thing to discover.
Yep.
It's fun to discover things. And The Prisoner is a certain world to reveal or I don't know what the word I'm looking for, to have these little treasures to find is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, mysteries that keep revealing themselves. Well, as with the Ace books, we don't want to tell how these stories end because I really do hope people would want to read them themselves. What I want to do is give a flavor of where the book goes. So the book opens in, of course, a similar awakening to number 6 and his arrival in the day and kind of feeling where things are and what's going on. And I asked Rupert, you've been to the village. He said, oh, yeah, many times. It is so apparent that both these men have been there because they write with this rich texture, richer than you even see in film when they're describing the way the village is laid out and the terms. And there was this one quote early on, very early on in the first part of the, I think, little chapter, where it says, and I'm going to attempt to read this to everybody, it says regarding somebody else he sees, they built this place to be a maze, an elegant obstacle course. The twists and turns are there to sap your momentum. And that fascinated me because when I started to think about it, with the few exceptions of aerial shots of Port Mirian, there are no real open vistas in that town.
I don't know. Is this something we've talked about before, or is there something in Miss Freedom that talks about no straight lines in The Prisoner too? Maybe there may be something in Miss Freedom about that as well.
It must, because I don't recall us ever bringing this up.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Yeah, I think there's something as well in there about no straight lines. No straight.
Yeah. And that is where, as I'm reading the fiction and I'm reading the prose, but then my mind starts to go into that thought that architecture for its own purpose is something that affects the way we see the world. So when the gentleman who created that village laid it out, he likewise knew that we're going to make this so that you kind of always meander your way through. And what it made me think about was two major streets I've ever been on in my life. I was in New York, and like most people do, I was on Broadway, which is in New York, 7 streets wide, and goes from lower Manhattan all the way up. And Manhattan's not very elevated. There's not a little change in topography. So when you stand on that street and you look, you really see a straight line. The other is in Buenos Aires. There's this massive avenue in downtown Buenos Aires that's multiple lanes across. And it's interesting because both of those were done intentionally to make a dramatic statement to the populations around them that we are a progressive place, we are moving forward, we are driving somewhere. Whereas the village doesn't want people to feel that way. And other architects build stuff so that you actually stay a little bit kind of askewed in the way you see the world. So I found that really interesting that they took that tact to kind of drive through it. But the book, insofar as where we're taking the character, is that like a show, it kicks off with something that number 6 discovers seeing another character, number 18, walking with someone, and then there's a fight. And we discover, this is intro to the book, that the other person has been killed. And it begins the idea of now, how does justice get served in the village? How does investigation, how do crimes and things happen? And it also weaves into those same things, which is the village says to him, well, we can extract the information from her. We can pull it from her brain. But if we do, we'll erase those memories. So it's back to that idea of, are you taking the idea from someone to take away the bad behavior, or are you taking away the idea so they don't do it again? And in this first chapter, it also moves into other people we find in the village, including, and this is one of my favorite parts, is the woman has been using the pretext of a magazine to not only filter out information, like coded to a degree, but also to gain information about other people because of gossip. So she uses people's inherent desire to be part of the story and to be part of telling their story to gather gossip and learn about other people. So there's all these levels of knowledge and information gathering. And she discovers and finds, not discovers, but knows, these group of young people called the Irrationals. Who are, instead of numbers, they're cosine and equals, plus, and things like this. They, of course, are hiding in one of those famous cages or caves in the village, but it did bring a different flair to it. And I found that the language they used was very 60s. It drew me into the book more back
into
the time.
So the book is set in the 60s?
Oh, yes, okay. Absolutely, in the time period of The Prisoner. And so that really made me feel like I'm seeing another part of this. But at the same point, along the way, it's not a dialogue-heavy book, especially the first part. Both Jonathan and Rupert are great at weaving these very dense descriptions. And that, for me, as somebody who, again, is not a fiction reader, made it slow-going. Like, I'm used to reading business texts, which is so point, just go. This, I found that I had to slow myself down so much because I didn't want to miss things. It's like every word really mattered. But then back to the idea of the book evoking other thoughts. As number 6 and number 18, once the crime has been committed and the idea of how the investigation may or may not go, number 18 decides to take on her own effort to either declare her innocence or find evidence as to this other person had been doing things to her mind. And in that path, as they're going around trying to collect information, we have this very pivotal scene where number 6 encounters someone that he used to work with. He refers to him as the minister. And in the very scene in the book where he sees him, number 6 runs up and punches him right in the face and knocks him out. There's a pause and there's a new chapter. And that next chapter is number 6, literally like a cat circling this guy, an older guy who's knocked to the ground, who he's just ravenously angry about. And they begin this whole polemic about who quit, who resigned, who was true, who was not true. And here's the other quote that I wrote down in big print so I can read it. This is what I think is the conversation worthy. He says, that the minister, who he's minister, you know, government person, that he's knocked to the ground, finally looks number 6 in the eye and he says to him, you were part of the covert enforcement arm of a self-interested government propping up an unjust society. You yourself decided that you couldn't be part of it anymore. You walked away. So did I. But when I left, and even before, I did everything I could to bring it crashing down behind me. You didn't leave, declares number 6. You just changed sides. And you managed to choose the one option that was even worse. Well, here's a thought, number 28. Has it ever dawned on you that the hero of our story, of our show, of our books, and all this is somebody who could have really been involved with some very, very, very immoral activity?
I imagine so.
When this,
you know, it's a matter of conscience,
right?
I mean, that's been stated. So,
but my thought is, what the book made me think was that this was not an accountant who quit his job. This wasn't somebody who was you know, the director of housing for the UK government. This is a person who was a spy. This was somebody who in their job had probably killed people and probably done things in the era of the 60s to, look, we know what the US did to Pinochet in Chile in 1971, literally overthrow a democratically elected government because we didn't want that government. And I started to think when I read this, I actually put the book down and started to think, how is it that Patrick and Lou Grade got us to be empathetic to somebody who may have been a very morally corrupt person in the work they did in that time?
Well, because he quit.
Right. But does quitting absolve you of the things you've done?
Well, you meet him after he's quit. You don't meet him when he's operating.
Right. Right.
And if you assume one way or the other that he's Drake, was Drake involved in immoral or amoral activities?
Well, if you look at the series of that, there were lots of things where he did things to undermine other governments that we just simply disagreed with. He did things to undermine individuals whose businesses we disagreed with. That's kind of a lot of hubris for us to think we were always right about everything.
Well, in The Prisoner, number six, always – my impression is that he's always – that he defends himself when he talks about which side he worked for.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem to be angry with – it seems to be a personal issue as opposed to he seems to still support his government.
Uh-huh. Right.
He doesn't seem to be angry with whatever Six's problem is. It doesn't seem to be with the side because he always defends himself as, I know which side I'm on. Yeah. I know which side I work for. I didn't switch.
And that's
what he seems to be loyal, but he just doesn't.
Right. And that's what the minister
– he's got other issues.
The minister is making the defense of his actions by saying, look, both sides are the same. I just changed another side and my intention was to try to bring it all come crashing down.
Yeah.
And I don't know. This is why, again, I love this program because you can stay inside the story or you can say the story generates my thoughtful conversation over a beer or a soda pop to talk about, wow. You know, it's 2019. You and I both know in today's news that we're still doing brinksmanship with other countries we disagree with, right?
Yeah.
Who knows if they're right, wrong, or indifferent, but we still use these, as the minister says, these arms of our government to be able to do things. And I just it's funny to me when I thought about it that a spy is not necessarily an angelic character for us to be so empathetic for. Right?
Well, no.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a complex feelings and views about any tribe, any ism,
right.
Any side. Yeah. To me, it's all pretty subjective. So, you know, personally, the way I feel about it is I don't know. It's hard to project, you know.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say right now.
No, I get it. And that's why I love this because we are – look, if we were reading something simple or if we were watching again a show that was simple, we would just gargle it down and go, that was good.
Yeah.
Look, behind the scenes, reveal. Over the weekend, as you and I talked, as friends, I told you a few things that happened that were a little stressful. So on Sunday night – I curled up and watched, and I will admit this to you and the world at public. I will admit the following.
You watched Thunderbirds?
Oh, no. That would have been even more complex. I watched Delta Force 2, The Colombian Connection, starring Chuck Norris, directed by his son, Aaron Norris. And the really sad thing – I know. The really sad thing is – I actually sat there and watched the whole thing.
Wow.
I didn't toggle. I didn't multitask. I didn't play on my phone.
No. Had to get your mind off of other things.
I did. And the thing is that I have nothing to tell you about Delta Force 2, The Colombian Connection, because there was nothing in it.
Yeah. I don't know that I could have. I don't know if I could have.
I just stared at it.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that this polemic and this theme and this creation of Patrick and the people that helped him make the show lives and is so compelling because even something as small as that one argument between two fictional characters, you quit, I didn't quit, it opens us up to have these bigger conversations in life. So,
well, it's also nice that conversation that you speak of is sort of deepens the mystery. It's right. It's not a conclusion that no. some post prisoner fiction creator has come up with.
No,
it's not a conclusion. It's a widening of the chasm, which is good. And I prefer that. To
I
sort
agree.
Of,
and know. And Jonathan and Rupert also wrote it in the same way. He didn't say which side the other one went to. We still don't know which sides they are.
Let me ask you something as an aside. How do they work together? Two people writing one novel. How does that work?
As he mentioned last week, he was saying, I'm a little vague, but he recalls that it was one of these things where they really propelled each other. One would write one chapter, then one would write the other, and they would crisscross to nudge each other through the process of writing the book. They had a map, but they would more or less trade off, and then they would harmonize the dialogue together back in an editing step.
Yeah, because I've written screenplays with people, and it was a long time ago, so yeah. I'm not even sure I remember how it worked. But it's an interesting notion to have two people write one thing.
But the book continues on in the development of where in the village we discover that they have an AI program called Juliet. And this program, very, very similar to the episode we recently discussed, which was the prognosticating one of It's Your Funeral, right? Mm-hmm. Where they had Wanda doing the idea of what would happen in the day in the life of number six. Well, Juliet is a much higher and more sophisticated version of that because it takes on the idea of every variable plus chaos plus randomness. And the book then in the subsequent chapters, 2, 3, and 4, becomes more and more complex and dense. It becomes a game of barter where the magazine is a conduit for things being bargained by 6 and 18 to get more information by having people contribute or be able to be written up in the magazine. It plays on the idea of the vanity of all of us and why that would happen. Then the book takes a hard turn into Adventureland. And where I got lost is that in a TV show, there are easy tells when something is kind of into the fantasy realm or like the dream realm. Usually no, especially in that era of TV that we love.
If they want you to know, yeah.
Yeah. In this, my problem was I would read and go, oh, well, that's happening now. And then there'd be a section break or a chapter break. And I'd be pulled back to realize that all of a part was part of a dream sequence or something like that. It's not a criticism. It's just an observation from, again, somebody who is not used to—
But it was designed to do that, right?
Absolutely.
It was designed to take you down the primrose path.
And eloquently well done.
Right.
And they leave the village—
As does Miss Freedom, I would
Yes. say. They leave the village, and what's amazing is they go into these other worlds, these other topographies. Part of this beautiful picture that Robert and his, I think, collaborator created, which I think is a real deep representation of the way the book goes. You leave the village into these other worlds of just 6 and 18 out in these areas. It's intense. I would argue that it's a very intense read. There are some parts of it that have to do with the interrogation that even bothered me insofar as depiction of violence. It was like a little intense. The dialogue that is key to representing Six and Patrick McGoohan, I felt was most of the time very on point. They tried to keep him quippy and quick. But as silly as this may sound, I almost wish the book had had more dialogue because that's what compels me to stay with the characters, not a lot of the narrative of the author telling me where and how and why they're doing it.
Right.
The dialogue is what keeps me reading quickly and fast to say, okay, where are we going? Overall, in general, when I bought this book back in 2006, I was ecstatic to have it because I didn't know at that time about the Ace books. I didn't know about any of the other stuff. I was still very novice to my prisoner fandom. And as you can tell by this copy, it's pretty well worn, right? I'm not gentle on books. When I read a book, I break the spine and I bend the pages because I want to know that I've enjoyed
heavy.
It. And it is heavy. It's an amazing contribution. And as I said to Rupert, I thank him for giving it to the community. I wish I knew more fiction fanatics who could tell me their opinion of it from just the point of view of a great fiction book. I know as a Prisoner fan, I was really pleased to read it. I'm thrilled to have it. And I'm really excited that there is the possibility that maybe one day we might get another.
Number 89.
Yes, sir.
Miss Freedom. Cartmel.
Mm-hmm.
Cartmel.
Andrew Cartmel.
Well, I really enjoyed this book, first of all, because I think ultimately it comes down to, did I like it or not like it? I liked it. Yeah. And I liked it because – mostly because it was – I thought it was very true to the show. Because to me – and I'll say this before we talk about anything, whether it's graphic novels or later when we talk about the Big Finish audio series. To me, the and it's obvious. The baseline is the television show.
Right.
I am a fan of the television show.
Yeah.
And it starts there.
Yeah.
Anything else is not going to be as good to me as the television show because I just don't know how that's possible. Because it would be something else.
Yeah.
I guess. It's a short read.
Mm-hmm.
It starts and ends with a really kind of a neat thing, which is a prologue, which is – it's a document. It's a document that you read that sort of is a sets you up for the story and then as a conclusion to the story in a way.
It's almost like a dossier, correct?
Yeah, it's a dossier. And it's that's well done and that's an interesting way to go because it does preface you. And then poof, you're in the village.
Mm-hmm.
McGoohan's voice is present,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's just about dead on. You can hear – and because at least when I read this stuff, I'm if it's number six and it's set in the 60s and we are to understand that it's the same number six, I read it as McGoohan.
Yeah.
And I'm very attuned to his voice and his cadence and his patterns of speech. So and the way he's his thought patterns, and they are present. And I really enjoyed that quite a bit. What is disturbing about it is the violence towards women in the book. It's uncomfortable, and it seemed gratuitous in its description. But then again, I don't read a lot of fiction, so maybe that's just what you do. Maybe that you describe violence in that manner. And I thought there was sort of – now I realize this is the 60s. It's set in the 60s. And there are things that are stylistic about the book that suggest 60s stylization and that kind of that sort of, if, dare I say it, playful misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
But there is some, you know, and I'm not a complete, you know, libtard about this sort of thing.
Right.
And I'm using libtard in quotes.
In quotes.
Yeah.
Well, it was Mateo who mentioned in the interview we did that Andrew wanted to write a true 60s sci-fi
and
story. I think he really – to the goal
and you
he
read
set
this,
himself.
Right?
Yes. To the goal he set, he achieved it 100%.
Yeah, I would say so. But I thought it was very true to the series, which I liked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that – because that's how I lean towards being pretty traditionalist when it comes to approaching this stuff. There were a few things that were a little odd. But for the most part, and there is what you know when you were talking about sort of the dream thing that's that you come to a point and it's like, oh, it was not what you thought it was. There is that. There is one of those.
Yeah.
But I thought it's played very well.
Mm-hmm.
There's some you know in the 70s rock bands wrote about being in rock bands, and this has there's a little bit about this about creative writing. It's actually kind of the spine of this story is about creative writing and about storytelling.
Okay.
So it's a book which is telling a story about
telling stories. Okay.
Which is a little you know, it's that little self-consciousness of a writer which I get a little uncomfortable with.
But does it seem like a bit of a crutch? Meaning you're using your own task to build your story?
Is it a crutch? It's certainly indispensable in this story.
Right.
I mean, it is the spine of the story, is telling a story.
Yeah.
And in some ways, it's given Cartmell the opportunity to write a story that in some ways has nothing to do with what you would think of as the prisoner in order to insert it into a story about the prisoner.
Okay.
So I will say that the stuff that takes place in the village, in the Green Dome, in these areas that we're familiar with, was more interesting to me than the story, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Well, that was more of a standard thriller, espionage, safe house,
spy story,
jumping out of planes, sort of stuff.
But that's true. You're holding true to the way you felt about episodes we've discussed, where you were always more enthralled with the ones that happen in the village versus those that happen outside of the village, whether it's in a book or in the TV show. So I think you're very consistent.
That's true. That's true. I'm not one of those ones that believes everything that if it's it's always nice when the television series stories are set in the village and we get those beautiful visuals and those things. However, something like A, B, and C, which I very much liked, doesn't have that.
Right.
And I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
But it did have the dome and, you know, people shooting drugs into people and all those things that always happen in the prisoner as well.
Or let's take, for example, Many Happy Returns, where the stuff in London, even though interesting, was never going to be as fascinating as the experiences Six has in the village.
Yeah, I would say that's true, except I really do like that episode. And I like when he's in London.
Yeah.
Because it feels, you know, like I said, what I always say about this show is it's about paranoia.
Yes.
And when you take Six and put him in London, the paranoia rises even higher because why am I here? How did I get here? Do I get to stay here? Mm-hmm. Is what's here real?
Yeah.
The paranoia ramps up. Yeah. When Six is in the village and he's in the village and stays in the village and stuff happens in the village, there are episodes where he's used to the village.
Yeah.
He doesn't give the village a second thought in some of these episodes.
Right.
There are stories that happen in the village, but they're not about escaping the village. They're not about paranoia in the village. They're about
Hammer and Anvil.
Yeah, right.
Hammer and Anvil, which we'll talk in a couple of weeks.
It's just him, taking mastery of the village.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I will say that the parts where he's in the village in this book were more interesting to me than the other stuff.
Okay.
The question, one of the questions that is posed even on the back of the book is a crack team of British espionage agents have been assigned to a dangerous top secret mission to rescue Number Six from the village. But can Number Six trust them? Is the rescue mission real?
Yeah.
Or just one more ingenious plot by his captors to get him to break.
Right.
So it does play that notion for a very long time.
Yeah.
And when it pays off, it's a little histrionic and I don't know. It's very big.
Mm-hmm.
It's very big in a way that's maybe bigger than it needs to be because it becomes a little sort of implausible in a sort of a James Bond Moonraker kind of way. But other than that, you know.
But that again was Andrew's objective. Big scale spy 60s kind of thing.
Yeah. Like I say, in all this stuff, it's just me. But the closer it is to the TV show, like another episode of the TV show, the happier I am.
Right.
Did
you find it a fast read?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, for me, but okay. I don't read fiction. So, yeah, I would say so. But there's an Asian cab driver. There's a colonel.
They always have a colonel. Right, there's always
a colonel somewhere. there was a number two who I don't know. It's an interesting thing, and it might be my brain, but I think it's probably a lot of people's. Whenever anybody reads a number two, they instantaneously assume it's Leo McKern. So I'm always watching Leo McKern. And then on the second sort of pass through it, I realized that wasn't really accurate. It was not really Leo McKern.
That's funny. I never think of him as that.
Really?
I think because he was so large and so bigger than life.
So specific.
That I always think of the other twos as being more small in character and demeanor, more petty or more vindictive, whereas Leo McKern was
humorous. I guess
when they're humorous, they're him because he was such a good clown.
Yeah.
He was their Pagliacci.
But again, you know, it rains. It never rained in the television show.
I'm sorry.
There again are these little things that are described that you would never that aren't TV-like. Well, yeah. The other thing about fiction, which is kind of obvious too, is that there are things that you don't see in a television show that you do see in fiction.
Right.
Actual internal monologues.
Yep.
For the most part.
Yep.
That sort of thing. Some details that are focused on that if they were focused on in the television show, it would end up being, I don't know, a multi-screen epic or something.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Again, the violence was a little much. I didn't think that was necessary. There's an agent called 666, which I thought was a little much. I don't know that we really need that. But again, just for the fact that just the fact that it honed close to the television show and that I thought McGoohan's voice was very much McGoohan's voice, which is a very important part of the show to me. I'll give it a thumbs up. But I enjoyed it, and it's a quick read, and I would suggest if you're a fan, go out and grab it.
On Thursday evening, August 14th, 1969, CBS television affiliates across the U.S. aired The Prisoner episode, A Change of Mind. When Number 6 refuses to conform, he is branded unmutual by the village and must undergo brain surgery to cure him of his individuality.
It is time for us to discuss A Change of Mind, number 28.
Gee, that should be the name of Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling.
That is true. Change of a lot
but
of things.
But it's not.
No, it's not. I know in the past that I've said that I think that Free for All is the episode I would give to someone if I wanted them to envelop themselves into the series and get the real feeling for it, that all at once you would understand Six and the village and the inside, the outsides. I stand by that.
If and someone, it's fun.
It's very fun.
It's fun.
I think that there are episodes that speak to me, like we've argued about the general, whether it's relevant or not. But this episode, this one to me is the largest, most profound, prolific, and important example of why in 1966 and 67, when Patrick McGoohan sat down to create this idea, he created a topic that is even more relevant today than it was then.
Yeah.
I believe the thematic of this is so important for our world to look at and watch today as a microcosm of exactly how these bad behaviors both manifest and get manipulated.
Okay.
I watch this one with not only interest but absolute passion, wanting to scream and say, but see, that's not how we're supposed to behave to each other.
Mm-hmm.
What about you? What about your thoughts?
I think of it as, well, that's true. It's definitely universal.
Yeah.
So as we go through this, I'd like you to connect it to specific things. Not necessarily specific things. Today,
right.
But generalized things today.
I can.
All right.
The whole idea of this is that Six is not complying with the group think. And right off the bat, we have this idea and the statement being made to him that we deplore your spirit of disharmony. Okay? Oh. Well, but we do this all the time in groups of any size. We're all going for pizza. You don't want pizza? No, I really want to get tacos. Why? We're all going. It's healthier. It's better for us. Blah, 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 blah.
Right.
I see this happen in the business environment
sure.
all the time.
Yeah.
And this is just an example where the village wants him to behave in a certain way. And he's going to say, no, I don't agree, but that doesn't make him evil. Yet they instantly cast him as evil, right?
I guess my concern in terms of how things are today or how relevant it is less the story of how someone is unmutual or goes against it as it is the fact that people group and do horrible things.
Right.
So anyway.
But
there may be two, that may be two sides of the same coin.
I assure you, no matter what significance you may hold for me, to the village and its committee, you are merely citizen number 6 who has to be tolerated. and if necessary, shaped to fit.
In this, I didn't take a lot of notes because I think I was more absorbing my feeling of how Six would feel. The idea is that he is not going to go along with what he's being told. And they want him to say the speech, follow it. Like, he goes off and wants to work out in the woods. They don't like that. You should be with everybody else. They want him to go and participate in the group think, where they're all sitting around in a circle and they're espousing why they're trying to be better and not be on mutuals. Right. And he's sitting there literally taunting them to say, I don't want to be a part of you. And that is so true to today. I have a friend, you and I both know, we're going to refer to as number 30. Number 30's daughter, who is 18 years old, is not only astute and intelligent, but she has a wisdom.
She's brilliant.
She is. And she has said to me in conversations, I had to extricate myself from my high school crowd because she goes, I could see to them and I could see through this sort of like social justice warrior thing. She goes, it was a false philosophy. She said it wasn't so much about protecting anybody else. It was protecting other people's weak egos. And you should protect people who need protection. But she goes, I just looked at every time I tried to raise a point of any contention, she goes, they tried to marginalize me. Hmm. And that's what's happening to Six here, is because his opinion doesn't match a, in this case, fear-based situation, or as you've said so many times so correctly, a paranoiac, then he's outcast. Now, to step away 1 second from that, because I always do like these little anecdotes, I have to tell you this. In the scene out in the woods where they're all discussing, there's the Chinese gentleman who is part of the conversation. Do you know who that is?
No.
His name is Michael Chow. Michael Chow was a UK resident who dabbled in acting in the 60s. His most famous role, if anybody has ever seen it, is in the Rush Hour with the high-pitched gentleman, Chris Tucker. He's in that. He plays a Chinese mafia guy, right? Well, his acting credits, if you look on IMDb, are pretty small. But his entrepreneurial efforts are amazing because he is the Michael Chow of the Mr. Chow Chinese restaurant chains that are in Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, London, including the frozen food division that sells Mr. Chow Chinese food.
I'll be damned.
So yeah, he wanted, I think, to do a lot of things, but along the way, the restaurant business is what turned this guy into a millionaire.
Restaurant has always been like theater to me. Everything the culture of the theater is applied to the restaurant. Every night is a performance. It will have leading man. It will have costumes. It will have backstage, front stage. It never bore the audience. All these details, all those billions of details, they filter into each other. They complement each other, become very powerful. Well, let's start from the beginning. I was born into a family of theater. When I was 12 years old, I went to London alone. From there, I was cut off from my culture, my country, everything that I'm familiar with. So there's the internal desire for me to reconnect. And restaurant was a vehicle.
When Mr. Chow began, there were no fine dining Chinese restaurants. There was almost a competition to be who was the cheapest. So my father felt kind of insulted personally, culturally, by the fact that his people were so maligned and regarded so poorly that he wanted to make sure that they were represented in the way that he felt was correct.
He started this 50 years ago when there was nobody else around doing this in that way. He thought that if he adapted the Chinese restaurant culture to the Western restaurant culture a little bit more, that he would be more successful over time. And I do believe that time proved him right.
My vision is to communicate from one culture to another, from one people to another.
Since as far back as 2015, I have been trying desperately to get in touch with him. Rick has, from the very onset, told me, you know, number 89, Michael Chow is in the United States. He believes he lives in Los Angeles. I have written so many times, even sent a packet of materials care of their corporate office, just saying, hey, we love that Michael was in this, and we know that he for a while wanted to be an actor. Would he love to share a few words about it? My sadness is I don't think it's ever reached him. But isn't that interesting?
Huh,
someone
I had
who,
no idea.
Yeah, went on to become a restaurateur and an entire food industry mogul. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Tell me more.
Delicious.
Very good. Yes.
Well, he's also in a scene where there's sort of a Greek or Eastern European guy. There's a – and, you know, that was nice to see. I always like it when the show seems to be cosmopolitan.
Oh, very much so.
Because it doesn't do as much of that as I wish it did. Theoretically, number two should have been international. You know, there should have been a different nationality for every number two that existed.
Yeah.
So that was something I liked. Hey, as a diversion, why black badges, why white badges? Have you ever figured out what the delineation is?
I have only assumed that was merely a fashion statement. I've never understood why, because sometimes the badges are smaller and sometimes they're larger. So in my own mind, I've just simply thought that they have a variety they could choose as long as they have the proper number on.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. But I have seen that.
Well, this is directed by Joseph Cerf, which is, of course, McGoohan. Yeah. And I think the stuff that – I think McGoohan's weird, and I think and I like it. So the stuff he writes, the stuff he directs always is a little stranger.
Yeah.
And I think his direction influences the DP, the director of photography, because some of the shots are different. Mm-hmm. There are more close-ups. There are some strange pans and zooms. When the fellow with the beard is talking about being a mutual, there's a strange pan down of the speaker and then pan up and pan down, which is disorienting and strange, and it's very McGoohan. Yeah. Number 42, weeping at the beginning, is very McGoohan. There's more humor in how the scenes are set up and directed as well.
Yeah.
McGoohan had a good sense of humor. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't seem to have a sense of humor, but it's evident in the show.
Right.
The aversion therapy with Rover number two is weird.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird.
I had that in my notes as well. The idea of the aversion therapy room where they're terrorized by seeing it come at him and at him, and he's tied into the chair and the poor guy. And it's like, those are those moments when you think to yourself, okay, this is the village being just downright cruel. And this is the village being manipulative. Now, it was to hurt that person in the chair, but it was also to manipulate Six for the fact they let him see it.
No, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's number 86 is beautiful. It's always it's always nice to see if you're a boy and you like girls, to see pretty girls in TV shows. So I liked 86. I thought she did a nice job. Yeah. Number two at one point says females, which is another one of these. There is a thing that runs through the show of, you know, females, she'll ruin everything, incompetent girl.
Yeah. I think the most pivotal scene in the entire program is when Six has gone back to his cottage and I don't know what they called themselves, the council, the committee of the four individuals are already there and they just start lambasting him. And he says out loud, you want a sheep.
Yeah.
You want me to be a sheep.
Right.
And they say, you're messing with my correction or my help. And the woman says, this will not be tolerated.
Right.
And I think about in today's world in no way, shape, or form am I saying that things that people do are bad should ever be tolerated. Not that. But I believe the whole social media thing has gotten so insane. I'll give you an example, number 28. A few weeks ago, when one of the U.S. state legislatures did another thing to retract women's abilities to their health care and their own procreation, laws are being retracted. There was an actress, and I'm not remembering her name right now, and I apologize to her that I don't. But she put out in her social media a tweet saying, well, if men of a certain age group and a certain economics are going to take over control of our productivity, our reproductivity, we need to take control over our sexuality and simply exclude them. Now, what she was saying was blunt, yes. But what she was saying was a cryptic way of saying, do you understand that this is a collaboration in this life? We all work together. We all come together. And people attacked her. Women attacked her. Others attacked her because dare you commercialize your sexuality? How dare you do? And it's like, you mean you're not allowing her to have her free speech to be able to say something? Everyone came down on her so hard. And then she had to retract it. It's like, no, you should never retract what you said.
Well, I mean, that happens to anybody about anything posted on social media at all. Yeah. I mean, that's one example, and there are millions of others. Yeah. And it doesn't really matter what it is. Yeah. If you have anything that is that anybody has more than one opinion about, people are going to destroy them.
Right. But if it's a one-to-one equation, that's fine. But it's when some group think says, oh, what you said is unacceptable.
Yeah.
That's what's so frightening about today's world. And that's what I see. In The Village, it was physical manifestation of a group of people in front of number six. Today, they don't even have the balls to get in front of each other. They just sit at their computers and typey type type and say, I am more than I am. So that's why this episode just really speaks to me. It really does.
This is the one where I thought the procedure was protracted. The frontal lobe. I mean, it's just like, God, what are you doing?
The click, click,
right
click, and then
here,
she,
you know, the focus
goes
to the, yeah, it was, well, that, it was that, but more than that, it was the description to the television audience of what was going to happen.
Right.
But I guess that's fine. I mean, you know, there's, you know. Here's the most remarkable thing in the whole show to me.
Please.
And it's in some ways a singular event in the entire series.
Yeah.
Where number six walks out to the water, walks out to a view of the ocean, and he looks up and he sees the flock of birds flying.
Yeah.
And he turns around and walks away. It shows number six, it shows that it's working and that he's lonely.
Yeah.
It was loneliness. Yeah. It was aching.
Yeah.
Loneliness. It was bizarre.
Yeah.
First of all, that McGoohan would sort of just allow that to be seen. First of all, there's nothing like it anywhere. There is no sense of interior emotional number six
doubt or fear or concern.
Nothing like that anywhere else.
No.
In fact, when I was watching it, I had to rewind it and watch it again to make sure I saw what I saw.
Yeah.
And he directed this episode. So that's, I mean, there's, you know, he saw a flock of birds flying together and he realized he wasn't one of them. And he felt sad. It was amazing.
Which is the beautiful problem with this entire philosophy. It's a community's needs and an individual's rights, and where do they cross? But the fact of the matter is that none of us will exist as individuals. We exist in a relationship with other people. We relate to people as friends, as colleagues, as lovers. You know, one of the most frightening things that science ever discovered in the 1960s, because they actually did this to children and they did it to monkeys, was that it turns out, well, as you know, I have limited vision, not completely blind, but I'm limited. When I grew up, I was around a lot of kids that were totally blind in the 60s and the 70s. Mm. And do you remember the old sort of cliche about blind people who would sway? Mm. They would move when they stood?
Like, I guess so, yeah.
Ray Charles would move from side to side.
Right.
Where that came from, where sociologists and scientists discovered it, was that blind children, most often by their mothers, were not swaddled, were not held, because they couldn't give their mothers this visual cue back that they were being seen. And so blind children were left unattended, meaning not coddled, not held. And that movement, that shaking back and forth, is a biological chemical reaction of the body to want to be nurtured. And they did experiments in the 70s with monkeys, where they would separate the monkeys from the mothers. And the monkeys who were swaddled and nurtured would never do that. Mm. And the monkeys who were left alone would shake and weave. Mm. And that's what I'm saying, is that though Patrick McGoohan, though number six, though we all believe I'm an individual, I want to be, it's a falsity. Because left alone to our own devices, we become, even without The Village, we become paranoid with our own, we become lonely, we become emotional. So he's showing us that in this brilliant episode. The problem is he's excluded not for the right reasons. he didn't do something wrong, so he's punished.
Right.
He was excluded because he didn't have the right mindset. And we do this to people all the time.
Right.
Yeah. What else as you followed your way through this? The post-treatment era, as I put it.
Well, I thought it was funny that when number six switches the little pills and gets number 86 high,
yeah.
That at one point she goes, "I'm higher."
Yes.
And he goes, "What? The number two.
Uh-huh.
That was very cheeky.
Very clever.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, and this is really kind of small, but this was a backlot episode. There were some scenes shot in Port Marion, very obvious, but a lot of it is that backlot where there's that hill outside of his door. And I always feel bad because I know it was a budgetary constraint.
Weird grass.
And it was a time constraint, but that just looks so quality-wise, so different than the views they got when they were tangibly on the set. I was like, oh, now you've taken me back to the fact that I know that this is in a studio.
Yeah, and the workout area and all that.
Yeah.
Where he's working out.
Yeah.
And his double, which is obviously his double when you're watching it on Blu-ray, you know, high definition.
So once, as you said, he dopes her up.
Yeah.
Then he uses his magical powers of incantation and his watch to hypnotize her, which I love how every spy in the 60s was a well-crafted hypnotist.
There was a lot of hypnotizing in the 60s. You know, right along with, what was the other thing we said that happened a lot in the 60s?
Quicksand.
Quicksand's one.
Brain transfer.
Yeah, brain transfer. Yeah,
there's a lot of those kind of things.
There was a lot of hypnotism.
So he hypnotizes her, sends her off to go back, and now what happens is the same simplicity of these people is that as soon as she, who's higher than him, as soon as she now labels him the unmutual, the crowd turns against number two.
Yeah.
And that again shows that this is a hollow philosophy.
Right.
Whoever is, I wrote in my note, I literally wrote the idea of name calling, how unbelievably immature but powerful it is.
Yeah.
Back to today's world,
yes.
We can label somebody, and I'm. Let's use a real vulgar one. Someone is a misogynist, right? Merely labeling that, now they're guilty, right? Yeah. But maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But the label sticks. It's like this mindset in the United States: you're innocent before proven guilty. But that's not true. You're indicted at the moment of being arrested, and you're implied to be a criminal because you're in the court. Otherwise, why would you be there?
Right.
So this idea that somehow labels don't matter, God, yes, they matter. And we all know now that nowadays there's words we're not even allowed to quote unquote use.
Right.
Words are heavy. Yeah. I always say we're supposed to use them for their meaning, not their sound, but we don't nowadays. We use them for their sound.
All villagers are encouraged to share their thoughts and contributions with the Eternal Village Cast. Please send your remarks care of info@theeternalvillage.org. Until our next program, be seeing you.